Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Sam Palazzolo, Tip of the Spear Ventures.
Sam, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. Before we dive in, talk more about your current venture, current organization, which I'm very excited about. Give us a thumbnail version of your career today.
Yeah, I'll give you a 30,000 foot overview. Go figure, a guy from Detroit goes to work in the car business, but that's where I initially cut my teeth from a career trajectory. I spent about 20 years, did everything from worked on an assembly line as a UAW member, so that's how I put my way through undergrad. After graduation, went to work wholesale distribution for a couple of different manufacturers like General Motors and Toyota Lexus. Threw in some consulting along the way, worked with Aon's Change Management Group as well as Deloitte, so come from big consulting, and then spent some time working retail ultimately in the auto industry, where one of my favorite dealers recruited me. And so we ran a large auto platform empire for a couple of years. So I get automotive industry as well as industry at large from those three main channels: manufacturing, wholesale distribution, and then retail. I had the opportunity, I had my own consulting firm for about 6 years. And then I had one of my favorite CEOs who outreached with a tech startup idea. It sounded good to me. I asked, how can I help, which is my nature. He said, I'm glad you like it, because I'd like you to come help me run it, which is what we did. We had a private equity exit after I'd helped implement and architect the sales biz dev blueprint. After about 22 months, so it was real firework. And then afterward, I started Tip of the Spear Ventures, and that's where we sit today.
Well, that's super exciting, and thanks for that overview. And it seems like a very diverse and interesting journey that you've been so far. So tell us a little bit more about Tip of the Spear. What's the value that the company provides, and what's the mission there?
Yeah, so Tip of the Spear Ventures, we're a unique private equity firm. I had a financial background, so it wasn't quite the moonshot to launch a PE firm, but I really enjoyed the private equity experience, especially our exit from the tech startup. But we formed the firm. We have two sides of the house, which is kind of unusual. We have a venture side of the house where we'll do our typical private equity type work. So early stage seed funding or funding for entrepreneurs that are post-revenue $1 million plus, that's our sweet spot. Primarily in a tech play, but we'll also do some other biotech, pharma, retail play every once in a while. We also do a business funding component on the venture side of the house, where we'll help organizations explore customer funding options to help grow their firms. And then lastly, we have an M&A play, where we're kind of late to the party. We've been doing that for about the last 3 years, but it gives us the opportunity to go out, explore primarily baby boomer led organizations in those unsexy industries like construction and manufacturing, where they've had enduring profitability year after year, and to kind of carry on the legacy when there's no clear succession path. So that's our venture side of the house. The other side of the house is a consultancy still. We do what Deloitte would call business transformation consulting, which is a fancy way of saying change management. It's got a heavy focus within a sales business development capacity and upstream downstream interaction with other departments within a business like marketing, operations, customer service, et cetera. So that's the firm. We're going to celebrate our 10-year anniversary next year. And on the drive there, we're doing some really great things right here, right now.
Well, that's super exciting. It seems like very diverse investment thesis from a standpoint of the industries or, even the geographical location as from an overall investment perspective. So you've seen the industry go from different directions as a venture capital or just overall. What are some of the trends that you're observing, these days? What are you researching? Where do you see the industry as a venture capital going moving forward?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think where we started out, we were good. I don't know how to put it. I want to say that we saw tech firms that were launching. And when we initially started Tip of the Spear, you know, we were a true early stage seed funder. So call it an angel investing, but way before a private equity firm, and certainly well before a venture capital firm would get involved with an entrepreneurial initiative. But we wanted to be leading edge, right? That's where, you know, Tip of the Spear comes from. We wanted to be first in and let's win. That's kind of our motto. And we were going to go in and kind of slug it out. I think when I look back on those early days, you know, we had an analyst at one of our annual summer meetings who said about year three, you know, these investments we're making in these early stage companies, we probably need to rethink our initiative here because we could probably get better returns by throwing our money out the sunroof of our cars. And so kind of one of those situations where, you know, we recognized early that, you know, the tech startups that we were looking at in the space, and maybe it was just our cutting our teeth and the educational investment. Maybe we can look at it from that perspective. You know, we've refined what our model is and how it is that we go to market looking for investments. Today, you know, I mentioned that we no longer do early stage seed funding. We'll look to partner, and strategically partner is the important term, I would put it, with those types of entrepreneurs that generally on their journey, they're post revenue, $1 million plus, and they're looking to engage with us to scale their operation. You know, there's certain growth stages, call it an S growth curve, that an organization goes through on its journey. And they generally have some inflection points at about the $1 million revenue mark on the road to 5, on the road to 10, on the road, so on and so forth. But those different inflection points stress an organization, not only the people, but the processes that they have put in place. And that's what we're really good at, is working through those types of challenging stress point moments on an S growth curve.
Right. No, absolutely. Those are definitely interesting observations in terms of where market has been, where it's going, a lot of different directions. So to switch gears a little bit, as you guys decide to fund a particular company or startup or founder, you know, one of the, at least for me, in my view, evaluation criteria for the founders is their abilities to recruit and build a team around them of top performers, which in the current market condition, you know, I would imagine is extremely challenging with candidate driven markets out there, especially in technology or other advanced sectors. It's very hard to find talent. What are some of the strategies that you deploy to help your portfolio companies succeed in this space when it comes to recruiting the top talent?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, we traditionally will look at the business in four different silos. We'll look at from a strategy, an execution, cash flow, as well as people. And the people one that you're hitting on is the most important aspect of it. What do they say? People are our most important asset. Isn't that the slogan that a lot of organizations want us to hear or want us to believe that they have going for them? And you're exactly right. You know, people it's a challenge. It can either be the greatest challenge or it can be the greatest opportunity as a startup or an organization goes through those growth curves that we mentioned earlier. Some of the things that we help do with these organizations is really just assess where it is that they're at from a people perspective. And, you know, it's kind of, we did some work with Marshall Goldsmith, you know, when I lived in San Diego. And, you know, Marshall Goldsmith, the executive coach of the Fortune 100, wrote the book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. There almost needs to be, in Jim Collins' phrase, a brutal facing of the truth, right? Or acknowledgement of these are the facts before you can move forward. And so from a behavioral assessment of who it is that's on the bus, to use another Jim Collins phrase, there's a great opportunity to find out, you know, are the people that got us here going to get us there? And do we need to top grade or upgrade our talent? And so we'll work with organizations to not only create that initial assessment of who's on the bus, so to speak, and are they sitting in the right seat on the bus, but more importantly, how is it that we can go out and recruit? You know, the recruiting initiative today is a relatively straightforward, and I won't say it's simple or easy, but it's the more straightforward or simple you make it, the better off you'll be. We typically find that, you know, you can approach, and it's easier today than it's ever been to get a hold of prospective candidates. The challenge becomes how it is that the individuals are onboarded into the organization. And we kind of reinforce a hire slow model, and then identify, you know, if we've got the right fit quickly, if that's a nice way of putting it. And part of that right fit quickly comes down to, you know, are they unwilling or are they unable? You know, if they're unable, that's on us as a team, right? We need to either provide them with better resources, better training, better, but that's on us to work through. If they're unwilling, that's on the candidate, that's on the individual. And that's where we probably need to, you know, allow them to go find their next opportunity, if that's a nice way of putting it. But right, I think so two sides of the coin. One is the recruiting initiative. The other one is the onboarding and the kind of the ingraining into the culture of the organization. That second half, that's where I see a lot of the organizations that we worked with in the past, the ones that have been successful, have spent the time to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely. No, that's very interesting observation in terms of, and it's such a difficult space as well, because especially for startups and the companies, you know, with not a strong brand just yet, for an entrepreneur or founder to be able to recruit and convince on the vision, I guess, I think it's one of the very unique characteristics of successful entrepreneurs out there. So that always fascinates me. In terms of emerging markets, the geographical locations, or whatever, you know, from that standpoint, what are you seeing out there? What markets are you on the lookout for? What do you think it would be the next kind of wave in terms of exceptional founders or exceptional deals to fund?
Yeah, from a geographic perspective, we'll start there. I think this is where the pandemic's been great. You know, this is how guys like you and I, we can connect, communicate, and meet each other virtually. You know, we don't have to hop on jets. And this is coming from the guy who, I think 1 year I tapped out at 48 weeks on the road. The pandemic's been awesome from the perspective of we can hop into these types of virtual meeting places, get to know each other. And so from a geographic footprint perspective, it's opened up all kinds of markets. We're seeing different activity today. It's just not in your traditional centers, right? It's not in a Bay Area exclusive. It's not in a Massachusetts. Those two states, California, Massachusetts, they count for, I think, 80%+ of venture capital funding goes to just those two places alone. So we're seeing a different geographic footprint open up, and it's been great. We're seeing things in an Austin, Texas market. And Austin's been great for well over a decade. It's just maybe the good news hadn't gotten out because they're trying to keep it weird down there. But we're also seeing some good growth in other markets like Denver, and even Salt Lake City has kind of a Salt Lake, Silicon Valley area to it. So, you know, geographically, we're seeing a much dispersion, I want to say a greater dispersion from traditional centers of population where, you know, prior to, that's where the focus needed to be. If you wanted to get into a startup or a venture space, you probably needed to go up to the Bay Area. You probably needed to be in Boston, right? Mm-hmm. Not anymore. So that's a geographic area. Some of the things that we're looking at from a tech perspective, you know, we love anything that's artificial intelligence or machine learning. There's a difference between the two. But we think that those are two areas that are certainly going to accelerate and accelerate the economy at large. We also look at the economy as being built on a blockchain technology. And so anything that has something to do with that, we're into as well. Those are some specifics within a tech space, but it kind of goes back to the people moment we talked about earlier. If we've got the right entrepreneurs that are in front of us, you know, the who is involved sometimes is more important than the what that they're doing, because the who, the people, they'll figure it out. Yeah. And so we look at the entrepreneurs as the most important variable when we assess an organization for investment.
So on that note, when it comes to, you know, founder market fit or just overall evaluating the founder, you know, the entrepreneurial pedigree, some of the things that, you know, from my limited investment experience as an angel, one of the things that I love doing is kind of following the digital breadcrumbs of that particular entrepreneur to look at even the college days. So were you, you know, did you build a club or did you join the club? Or, you know, the analogy of are you a cartographer? Are you a navigator? So those are some of the things that I subscribe to in terms of being able to get an ideal glimpse into the type of entrepreneur that's a consideration. Share with us some of the areas or some of the things that you look for when you meet the founders. What are some of the things that make you think, okay, this is definitely, you know, a, you know, something I want to move forward. Just give us a glimpse into that.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier the hiring philosophy of hire slow and then remove quickly or eliminate quickly. It's kind of a similar thesis when it comes to the investment process. We're going to invest in a slow walk. It is not going to be a quick, you know, we'll still to this day, and I'm not certain why, I think I know why, but still to this day, we'll get these phone calls from entrepreneurs or somebody will approach me from the network saying that we need, you know, a significant sum of cash and investment in a relatively short time period, short time being, you know, 45 days or less. I had one last week where the gentleman needed some funding within about 5 days. And we're never going to accomplish that. It's just one of those things where maybe it's my accounting upbringing where I want to have some analysis time to conduct it. I promise not to get paralyzed by it, but we're going to invest slow. And we're going to do some deep dives into the backgrounds of the founders just to find out a little bit more about who they are and how they tick. And the details can be very similar to what you described. You know, we want to find out, you know, what did they belong to? What clubs were they belonging to when they were in college? And were they not necessarily, were they the joiner or the starter of the club, but what were their roles within the club, right? We want to find out some particulars about what was their course of study. You know, I instruct an exec ed course over at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas annually. And you know, from a student perspective, I want to know, you know, where did they come from? What did they study? What were their favorite elements? And it probably goes even back further than that. You know, we're also good explorers of what was the atmosphere like where you grew up? And, you know, I'm a firm believer that while there is a certain element of nature, I think there also is the nurture component. And, you know, tell me a little bit about your folks and what do they do for a living? You know, my mother raised me and she kind of instilled in me the, you know, tell me who your friends are and I'll tell you everything there is to know about you. And she, to my benefit, got rid of a lot of potential friends that would come by the house when I was younger, because she would simply pull me aside afterward and say, you know, that kid, yeah, he's not invited back. I would recommend not staying around him, which was my mother's nice way of saying, you know, don't let me catch you around that kid again. Mm-hmm. But that kind of goes back to the, you know, I'm also a firm believer in it's not only the people you surround yourself with, but it's really what kind of books are you reading or what are your hobbies? You know, we used to spend a lot of time when I was in automotive retail, go figure, it was a great environment to potentially take an interview candidate out for a round of golf. And while I no longer play golf, I recognized at that time that it was a great opportunity to spend 6 hours with somebody. You get to see how it is that they handle successes, but more importantly, and especially in the game of golf, how it is that they handle failures. So those are a couple of things that we look at. We're trying to identify, again, best fit, not only for can we make some money, but do we want to be around these people? Because investing in organizations, and you know this from even if you have limited angel investment experience, you know there are some organizations that they just won't give up. And while it's great from a stick-to-itiveness, you kind of wish that they would. Because so one of those types of situations, but it's a long-term cycle for us, and we take our time in investing.
Right. No, those are great observations and frameworks when it comes to evaluating the founders, because it's a long-term investment. It's a long-term partnership. Startup funding is, from my experience, when I've raised capital or I've invested into startups, it's a minimum 7 to 10 year journey, and you gotta look at it as, is this someone who I will enjoy working with for the next, 10 years? And from the entrepreneur side, who to take money from is also an important consideration, because, as you know, from a VC perspective, VC, it's like an employee or a boss that you can never get rid of, right? So it's an important dynamic from that perspective.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I think the more strategic you are on who it is that you want to invest in the firm, this is also how we coach entrepreneurs through the process. There's going to be some investment that you're willing to take because, the money's just presented to you. And as an entrepreneur, you know this as well as I do, you need money, right? This is how the dream comes to reality. It's not from a wish, it's from a cash type of a perspective. There's also, though, some investors who can be real strategic partners, and they can be connectors to markets, they can be connectors to technology. Those are really valuable strategic partners to have as investors. So I think that the better off you can be in identifying who it is that you want to have sitting at your boardroom table, that's the strategy that you should go at.
Right, absolutely. When it comes to building a quality deal flow, that provides you with very unique perspectives into what's out there, but at the same time, give yourself exposure into, wide variety of deals that you would take into consideration. Share some strategies that really help you succeed in that space in terms of building a quality and quantity deal flow that really provides you with unique perspectives into really what's out there.
Yeah, I'll go back to the from a deal flow perspective. It's very similar to who it is that you surround yourself with. While we're leading at the tip of the spear, and I have still that fighting spirit of first in wins, I know this much, that you can go fast alone, or you can go big as a group. And we really rely on our network to provide us with opportunities. We're not going in this thing alone, and so we'll have these conversations with peers regarding, what are you all seeing right now? Who are you investing in? And are there opportunities that we should get involved with and partner on? Those are the best investments from my perspective. It's just not investing in entrepreneurs, it's who's going along for the ride from an investment community as well. So finding out from a peer network what it is that they're looking at and what they're investing in, it's crucial. I'll also say this much, that there are deals that we are approached on or with or to that aren't right for us. But it doesn't mean that there's not somebody within the network that it could be perfect for. And so we're constantly referring those types of initiatives or entrepreneurial initiatives over to people within the network. It gives us the opportunity to, maybe it's a good karma moment where we're able to provide a resource or a potential investor to the entrepreneur. It comes back to us in spades, though, from the investment community, because there's kind of a quid pro quo, or a what's not right for me might be perfect for you, and vice versa. So there's that type of an exchange as well. But we rely heavily on our network. It doesn't mean that we're not looking and researching and trying to find and connect with entrepreneurs. We've been really fortunate from that perspective. It's kind of a that's kind of an organic, and there's much more work involved. So we're more comfortable working with our investment peers just to find what are the best deals and what are they doing. And we might not necessarily be the subject matter experts. We might not be the smart money who can come to the table and provide some of those connections that we talked about earlier, either insight into technology, introductions into markets. But we like who's surrounding us at the investment table. And we want to get involved because of that. And more times than not, that's how it is that we've done it as well.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's, when it comes to quantity, I would imagine you have to be very careful when it comes to the ratio as far as quality goes, in terms of seen a number of, you know, presentations or, you know, the attending demo days and so forth versus how many you actually select for maybe a consideration on the next round. It's always that balancing act mm-hmm. that you have to play as an investor. So that's always interesting to me how some of the strategies that you deploy to be able to do that. As far as any of the deals that you may have missed and, you know, that anti-portfolio, as they call that, in terms of, I'm sure you have ton of stories, ton of, you know, examples, but more importantly, what are some of the things that you've learned from those missed opportunities and how did that shape or impact, if at all, your investment thesis?
Yeah, I mean, we've been pretty fortunate. I mean, I had a partner who one time told me that, you know, a series of near misses of success are how it is that you can characterize our investment thesis. And I thought to myself, wow, now this is a peer of mine, you know, and we partnered on a couple of initiatives together. But I thought, wow, that's really just a lousy way of looking at it. You know, there's going to be some investments that are going to make sense to you. And there's never a bad one from my perspective. You know, there's always something for us to afterwards kind of autopsy or recognize, you know, why did we do it? What were the benefits of it? What are we learning as we're coming through this? And how can we take what it is that we learned to the next deal and even spread it around to our current investments? So that way we have maybe not necessarily a bet hedge, but if we went through it and it wasn't going well, what were some of those things? I'll give you a great example of it. So back when John Doerr from Harvard wrote his objectives and key results, the OKR methodology, we recommended it to one of the entrepreneurs and initiatives that we were investing in. And we said, basically, you know, hey, look, this is the methodology that we'd like you to employ. And on a monthly basis, we want to see what it is that you're working on, what the results of it are. And more importantly, what do you have on the horizon to accomplish next month? And that should be the report out cadence. Obviously, you know, we're going to try and touch base with them much more frequently throughout than just a 1 month, one interval per month type of a connection. But it was one of those things where they took that OKR methodology, they implemented it into their system, and it became kind of, instead of waiting to get the phone call from the investment community, they almost newsletter put it together and sent it around to everybody, beating everybody to the punch of, I wonder what's going on over there with this group. We like that methodology so much, that OKR methodology. We employed it in each one of the investments that we've made. It's kind of our, they can do it formally, we can do it informally, but it's kind of our methodology that we've adopted. Because, you know, it's important to stay in touch and in tune with what it is that the entrepreneur is facing so that way you can assist, right? And I mentioned we're looking for strategic partnerships. This isn't just an investment vehicle for us. We really want to grow these firms because the better they perform and they do, the better we perform and we do. So we look at this as a true partnership. But that OKR methodology, one example of how it is from an autopsy of an event that probably it went good. We recommended it to another firm so that they could do better. It's been the best thing that we've done.
Right. That's a great example from the OKR perspective. I didn't even think about that from that standpoint, how that applies, especially in this particular context when it comes to investment opportunities. So that's very, very unique. So definitely thank you for sharing that. In terms of your personal content diet, the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed of what's in the market, what's ahead, share with us those sources and strategies to keep your mind, you know, with so much information overload out there. How selective are you in terms of letting your mind be exposed to everything?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because I think the, you know, content is everywhere and anybody can produce content today. And so, you know, I probably am biased from, you know, the adjunct faculty work that I do as a professor at UNLV. You know, I have access to some really great content that's out there. And I want to limit my content to, you know, obviously it's kind of like the projects that I work on. You know, I said 6 years ago that I was only going to work on projects that I wanted to work on with people that I wanted to work on them with. And part of that people moment comes down to I want to work with people that I know, love, trust, and respect. Those four things, know, love, trust, and respect. And I very much look at content that I consume coming at me from those people who I know, love, trust, and respect. It's got to come from either a referral or someone in that type of space for me to come in contact with it. And that's worked for me. I wish I had found that earlier, because my life became much more simple as a result.
Right. Absolutely. No, that's, in terms of just content overload, it always fascinates me how, with the abilities or some type of a framework to keep yourself, you create your own bubble, so to say, in terms of content.
And we're creators of the content too. I want to say 4 years ago, I launched the Javelin Institute. The Javelin Institute is our 501c3, a nonprofit entity where it's a nice creative outlet for me. I published 5 books. I'm certain we'll put 2 of them in the show notes. But I think it's one of those things where the nonprofit, its focus is to provide executive education. And so we're constantly doing webinars and workshops, and we've got some online e-learning courses that participants can come and take advantage of. I wanted this nonprofit to actually, and I know from a government perspective, the IRS says executive education or education at large qualifies as a nonprofit institution, but I actually wanted the proceeds to go and help people. And so it's an executive education system where a portion of the proceeds go to leaders who face family hardships. And family hardship, from my perspective, boiled down to the 4 D's. Hardship in the form of either a death, disease, divorce, or a drug dependency. So leaders who face family hardships, my goal is to get them back up and through those hardship moments and as quickly as possible. The deceleration of performance, we want to get them back with foot mashing down on the accelerator, as the saying goes, so that way they're back up and running out of those family hardships. So that's kind of our passion play. We're creators of content at large. I think I have over 300 articles. I have over 200 posted on LinkedIn. Wow. So we publish heavily. And like I said, for me, it's a creative outlet. And it's one of those things where for the audience who comes in contact with us, with it, it's a great way for them to find out a little bit about what it is that we're doing. And it's been a wonderful experience from that perspective for me.
Yeah, that's impressive. That's quite a library of content that you generate. That's super impressive. When it comes to advice or recommendations that you would provide to emerging, fund managers or first-time fund managers, taking yourself back to the early days, what advice really stands out that you would probably give to yourself as if you were to launch a new fund?
Yeah, we have one right now, and I have great partners. Right, I surround myself with really great people. I'm super fortunate from that perspective. One of my fund managers, my partners on one of the funds, comes from a legacy family office. I asked him, I said, "What's the family office's philosophy?" And he said, "My dad told me we only have 2 rules. Rule number 1 is don't lose any money. Rule number 2 is see rule number 1. And so I kind of think at its simplest form, that those 2 rules, which it's really just 1 rule, don't lose any money. That's the key aspect of it. I think if you peel the onion back though, sometimes the fun of having a fund is diversification and looking at some new technology or some new innovative way in which a market can be disrupted. And I think anytime you can look in those types of spaces and invest, that's kind of what keeps things, fresh and exciting. But if you can fall back on my partner's 2 rules, don't lose any money, and that's rule number 1. Rule number 2 is see rule number 1. Those are probably best cases when it comes to investing too.
Right. No, those are great recommendations. I appreciate you sharing that, realizing how loaded of a question that is. Last but not least, Sam, what are you currently reading, and what is one book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
Yeah, I think the book that I always come back to, the first book I wrote was back in 2008. It was called The Influential Leader. I went out and I interviewed over 100 leaders with the simple question of what do you do to be the best leader you can be? That was the premise behind The Influential Leader. When I was at Toyota Lexus, we did a lot of work with Robert Cialdini out of Arizona State University. Robert is the world's foremost social psychologist on the topic of influence and persuasion. And he just came out with his latest edition. He's added one more principle of influence and persuasion to the mix. And that's the book that I recommend the most often. That was the thesis, I want to say, behind The Influential Leader, because if you're a leader without influence, you're probably not that effective of a leader. And so the book that I recommend the most often is Robert Cialdini's Influence. New edition out this year. And as I mentioned, he's got a new principle that he added primarily because of the pandemic and the social influence that can be had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great recommendations. We'll make the titles available in the show notes. And, you know, his books and thoughts overall on negotiation and the influence, I think, is as a thought leader, it's very exceptional. So definitely, you know, thank you for that recommendation. Sam, I can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short and insightful conversation. I personally learned quite a bit. What I love doing with a lot of guests is do a follow-up episode recording in about a year, revisit what we had discussed last year, and see if everything that we've touched upon still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you.
No, that would be great. I know that a lot of the listeners, we talked earlier about the four pillars that we look at from an investment thesis: strategy, execution, cash flow, and people. We spent some time talking about people. We put together a series of success questions that you can ask yourself, as well as your team and your organization regarding people. We'll put those available in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. Definitely looking forward to that. Thanks so much, Sam.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.